Good morning. It's a chilly one. I hope you're warm and cosy. And if in doubt, yes, turn over. Oh, and Happy New Year, tinsel back in its box. And after all the excess, you might be feeling a little bit chubby, a little bit boozed out, maybe just a little bit broke. Well, if so, this one's for you.
Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. I have no money to pay my rent. All my money has been spent. Pray to God again or why. Satan, please hear my cry. Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. All I see is pain and death. I'm not the people with bad breath. Say the world's gone to hell. And that would be just as well. Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now.
After the splurge, the purge. Dry January, sitting in those pennies, won't count themselves. And as we kicked off the year, quite predictably, items aplenty on reinvention and reinvigoration every year, the triumph of hope over experience. Run that marathon, kick the midweek drinkies, stop the potty mouth. The Lord loves a trier. And it is as true today as it was back in 1989. Because, unsure it was better, Will Hannifin and crew brought us these voices from The Jimmy Greeley Show.
My New Year's resolution was giving up smoking. Because 2 years ago, my New Year's resolution was give up the drink, and I did, and I'm still off it. So if I can do it with drink, I can do it with cigarettes.
Well, to keep going out as much as I'm going out, and keep seeing as many men as I'm seeing, so I'm just following last year's resolution.
Olivia, first of all, what's your New Year's resolution? I knew you were going to ask me something awkward, my God. I remember somebody asked me this time last year, and I can't remember what I said, and whatever it was, I hope I kept it. But I suppose if you were to ask me now, and I'd tell you on the spur of the moment, it would be very much to think positive, up early in the morning, make use of all the minutes of the day, not waste time. Like, it's very easy to sort of get up in the morning, stay in the dressing gown, have the breakfast and make phone calls, and not necessarily now chit-chat phone calls. A few of them might be here and there, but a lot of business calls and things. You're still in your dressing gown, little do they know. But and the whole day filters away in you, whereas if you actually get up, have the shower, get dressed, put on a bit of makeup, it motivates you for the day. You seem to get loads of things done. So that'll be one of the things now that I want to do from January 1 onwards.
Not to pick my nose and eat it, and not to eat sweets, and not to fight with my brother and sister, and not to fight with my friends.
I live in this house with all these young people, teenagerish type young adults, and there are thousands and thousands of odd socks in sacks and bags all over the place. And starting in 1990, I'm going to put an end to the odd sock syndrome. I'm going to hand out safety pins to everybody. And everybody's going to pin the socks together as they come off them, and they're going to go to the machine, out of the line, out of the machine, back in pairs.
I'm going to try to get on with my mum, try to like my sister, and try to pay attention in class, because I always get detention.
You always get detention, do you?
Yeah, because I talk too much.
I suppose I'd only really have one big one, and that'd probably be to stop smoking. I'm trying to stop for the last 5 or 6 years, and I suppose now is as good an opportunity as any. Maybe I'll cut down a little bit in drinking and going out as well. It's kind of wearing on the brain.
But scroll just a few short days forward. How were they doing?
Your New Year's resolution was to give up cigarettes.
The hardest part was on New Year's morning, waking up and coming down and having breakfast and reaching for a pocket with no cigarettes in. And then suddenly realising, oh yes, my New Year's resolution is I'm off them. So I'm determined to stay off them, and I have done up till now, so I think I'm doing okay.
I tried not to fight my sister, but I had a terrible fight with my sister, so I suppose that one's out anyway. And my mum, well, I never get on too well with her, but I got on all right with her, so that one's okay. And I haven't got back to school yet, but I'm going to try and pay more attention in class. And I mean, I do intend on doing that.
Your New Year's resolution was to cut down on drinking and to stop smoking. How are you getting on?
Fine. Well, it was fine for the first day and Then it started to fall apart a little, but I'm trying to get it back together slowly, and slowly is the key word there, I think.
I kept not to eat sweets. I kept not to fight with my friends. And I kept not to grow up smoking, and I kept not to bite my nose and eat it, but I didn't keep fighting with my brothers.
New Year's resolution was Operation Odd Sock. And so far it's been a howling success. I'm seeing socks in pairs, pinned safely together, tucked into each other even, and there's hardly any loose socks floating around them. It's looking good.
Your little brother's resolution was not to pick his nose and not to fight with you. Did he keep them?
No, he picked his nose in the car today, and he fought with me today, the day before that, and the day before that.
My resolution was not to eat after 10 o'clock at night, but on the 2nd of January, my mother-in-law brought me some choux pastries and I couldn't help myself.
Asher, that's only a bit of stock management. You wouldn't want the food waste. And all of that from Sure 'Twas Better. But if you will insist upon a few resolutions, take Fiona O'Malley's advice. She is the CEO of Turn to Me, and she spoke to Una Kelly on Drive Time.
I suppose everyone associates New Year's with resolutions, oftentimes drastic resolutions, such as losing a huge amount of weight or going on an extreme detox. And instead of setting lots of unrealistic resolutions, which can often lead to disappointment if they can't be maintained, it might be better to set smaller number of realistic goals, which can be more achievable. So, for example, if you rarely exercise and your New Year's resolution is to go for a 5K run every day, that might not be realistic, and it might also result in injury if you push yourself too far, and that can lead to longer periods out of action. So it might be better to jog twice or three times a week. Goals that aren't realistic can lead to disappointment or feelings of failure, and this feeling of failure can deter people from setting future goals. It's easier to make consistent sacrifices than drastic or transformative changes. And people also find it more difficult to make new friends as they get older, which can often lead to loneliness. In fact, loneliness was a very common presenting issue for the people who used Turn to Me's services over the Christmas period. So we would encourage people to consider, instead of giving something up, to start something new, maybe to join a choir, join a book club, a hiking club, or consider starting a course, which can lead to new friendships as well.
And if you're looking online at everyone else living their best lives as you sit on the couch, finishing off the packet of Duck Crackers and scrolling, take heart.
You're constantly being bombarded at this time around ways that you have to change, and that kind of messaging that you're not enough and you have to fix yourself. In your experience, what impact does that have on people?
It can have certainly a detrimental impact on people's mental health, and particularly when we compare our lives to what we see on social media. I always say when you compare your life to what you see on social media, it's like comparing your life to an advert. It's a glimpse into a heavily edited snippet of someone's life. It's not a depiction of reality. And when it comes to the New Year's, everyone signs up for a gym. I imagine the gyms are filled with a tsunami of people trying to better themselves after overindulging over the Christmas period. But maybe starting something that might lead to more long-term success, like a hiking group or a walking group, might be better. And again, we'd encourage people to consider smaller, more realistic resolutions, or starting something new instead of massive, complete lifestyle changes.
Oh, she's not wrong. And Mr. Fitness Carl Henry joined Colm O'Mungon. And Colm asked about eating your feelings. Yes, channeling boredom through the medium of whispers.
Sometimes people eat, you know, the less healthy foods when they're in a particular mood. I mean, should they sit down with that same pen and paper that they're talking about and go, you know, when do I eat the bad stuff? Why do I eat the bad stuff? And maybe how can I change the reason I'm doing that in 2025?
Absolutely. Like, we all stress eat in some way, shape or form. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a reaction to a very stressful life. And life is phenomenally stressful. And identifying that is important, but also not doing what everyone has done. And you see it all over, I've seen it all over Instagram the last 2 days. It's, I'm never having a takeaway, you know, no takeaways this year, no alcohol, no chocolate, no crisps. The no diet doesn't work. And the no approach to 2025 doesn't really work either. It should be balanced. So whatever you struggle with, from if it's food or if it's movement, like trying to cut it all out is never a good idea. So you want balance. You want that 80-20 approach where you can say, okay, well, look, I might have I've had three takeaways a week over the last 3 or 4 months. I know that's not good for my health. I'm going to have one. And that's a significant improvement for your health. Significant. Or I got no exercise for the last couple of months. Therefore, I'm going to do one session a week. One session of half an hour in duration. And you're succeeding at those tasks. And by looking for 2025 to succeed and set yourself up to succeed, is that it's really, really important. But don't aim to cut every... By cutting everything out, it is short term. And that's what businesses right. thrive off this time of year. We don't want that this year. We want long-term health and long-term succession.
And if you are setting goals, be smart about it.
Vagueness when it comes to goals doesn't really work. It has to be specific. It has to be concrete. You have to feel it and mean it and want it. Right. They're all the things that will help you to succeed as opposed to leaving it quite vague. Write it down, make it concrete and make it happen.
And update the goals regularly then. Update small specific goals rather than trying to have one to last the year, is it?
Well, you can. See, that keeps it fresh, right? So the goal reward theory comes in there. So if you set a goal, say for the next week, I'm going to go to bed at 10:30 and you nail it. Brilliant. Give yourself a little reward. Now, that can be a different thing for each person. Then set a different goal because you've succeeded at that one. So it's like building a house, right? It's brick by brick by brick. Well, this is the same theory. It's that 1% atomic habits kind of rule, you know, that James Clear talks about all the time. It's that you nail it and it works, then add to it. Okay. And then you're building up and up over the, as people are failing around you, you don't, you're succeeding because you're setting yourself up for success by having those small changes over a longer time frame.
Carl Henry with Colm. And proof positive that if you do stick with it, you might just get somewhere. Author Adele Coffey, who joined Brendan Courtney in for Oliver, and she has been weightlifting.
So tell us what you discovered about the overall benefit. And there's a massive benefit for women as well, isn't
yeah,
there, at a certain age?
And this is one of the other reasons that I decided I would go back to it because, you know, I am technically perimenopausal, even if in my head I am a vibrant young woman. So essentially, weightlifting for women is really important for protecting against osteoporosis and also protecting against muscle loss, which happens as
you
get
age.
Older.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's just an incredibly good defense against these things. So when I started weightlifting, I wrote an article about it for the Gloss magazine just over a year ago. And I look back on it now and I see in those pictures, I'm using this tiny little kettlebell,
yeah.
which is the other thing we should mention. First of all, anyone can weight train. It's not niche. You don't have to be into it. You
the other benefit, right, to just get that in, January, we've all been eating, right?
Yes.
And we probably think, new year, new me and all that stuff, right? The real benefit is when you grow muscle, it takes
burns calories.
Loads of calories.
All
more,
day long.
More than cardio, yeah.
Yeah, it increases your metabolism.
Massively.
So it takes more energy to
We're
burn
really into this,
muscle.
Aren't we?
Yeah, so like for vanity reasons, just saying, yeah. it does a job.
It works, yeah.
Interesting. And she is all about the process.
The thing that I've really learned over the past year is just to trust the process. It's a phrase that my trainer uses all the time. Trust the process. Just accept that nothing's going to happen immediately.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen rapidly. You might not even enjoy it for the first few months. I found it very difficult. You're dying in the gym. You know, you're trying to lift these little weights and you're like, how can this be so hard? But actually, if you stick with it and just do these 2 hours every week and just get through that and just keep that as your goal, you start to improve. And amazingly, just before Christmas, I did my last session with my trainer and I was pressing a barbell above my head, you know, and she said, I'm so proud of you. And I kind of felt really happy.
Yeah.
I just thought, oh, and she said, think about what you were able to do above your head a year ago. And it was so true. I really struggled with a much lighter weight. And sometimes you don't recognize the progress you make because you're making it very slowly. But I think slow progress is actually much more sustainable than, you know, going out and saying, I'm going to just drink green juice all week.
Oh, yeah,
I'm going to work out
do it.
Five times a week.
Set yourself too high a bar.
Exactly. And then you feel like you failed when you stop. So set the bar low. Do something you think you might enjoy. So just start.
While keeping the bar low. Adele Coffey with Brendan. We will all be 22% better by this time next year. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The time between Christmas and New Year's can be quite lovely. And in terms of the radio, some magical programmes in primetime slots. and few more beautiful than this offering from Custodians of Ireland. Michelle Brown was on the Kilcorman Bog, also known as the Grey Lucas Marsh, in West Cork.
Hear me, a story. Go, Moyaloch, Agus Grian.
As a child, the bog was a big part of my life because when you're lying in bed at night and early in the morning, you could hear the cry of the curlew. And I used to do a lot of exploring there as a child, particularly when the bog dried out in the summer. And it was full of moorhens. There's a bit down there on the north side called the Stray River, which runs from the bog down onto Dunian Strand. And that was full of moorhens. And over this side, there were lots of curlews here. So it was full of life. And you'd often see the otters used to forage down on the strand, on the White Strand. They go across the road getting crabs, because I spent a lot of time fishing down on the strand when I was a child. And they'd go back and forth into the bog at night.
That's Jerome Lorden, a local fisherman and historian. And Michelle also spoke to Claire Deasy, a National Parks and Wildlife Conservation Ranger. And she took us on a walk through the bog and talked about the kinds of birds we might see.
If you spend any time in Garrowstone or Gary Lucas, you're guaranteed to see and hear chough. The Seven Heads SPA for chough is only over the road here, and there's 11 breeding sites for choughs in that SPA.
An SPA is a special protection area.
And so that's a very interesting habitat because you've got other amazing bird species like peregrines. So they're all adapted and nest on cliff faces. And it's very important, like it's a species that's really thriving in Cork and in Kerry and along the southwestern seaboard there. And we support nearly 46% of the chough population in Europe. So it's very important we keep their numbers stable here.
And if you don't know what a chough looks like?
Beautiful black glossy feathers, really strikingly black, you know. I mean, other corvids have black, but jet black. And then a beautiful hooked, slightly curved red beak and bright red feet. So it's an amazing colour contrast with the black and the red. And the call, you hear them before you see them. That's their kind of their giveaway, is when you hear them and you look up and you see them then flying, bouncing along. They're amazing acrobatic flyers, tumbling and doing somersaults in the wind.
Oh, one to listen and look out for if you're on the bog this year. All on Custodians of Ireland. And on Editing Ireland, a celebration of the work of David Marcus, perhaps best remembered for his new Irish writing page in the Irish press between 1968 and 1986. Here's poet Mary O'Malley.
Long before I had any contact with the Irish literary world, the name David Marcus was familiar. He was, for writers of my generation, as central to contemporary writing as the Dolman Press and Poetry Ireland were to Irish poetry. I had first become aware of him through his translations of The Yellow Bittern and The Midnight Court, but in that nebulous way of patron saints and recording angels, he was always in the ether. At some point, I started reading the new Irish writing page in the Irish Press. There I first read Desmond Hogan, Neil Jordan, Dermot Healy, and Deirdre Madden. The stories in the Irish press were fresh and varied, and owed as much to Carson McCullers and Anton Chekhov as they did to Martin O'Kane or Brendan Behan. There was a kind of literary democracy behind the editing of the pages, in the breadth of subject matter from jazz to trawlers, from Wexford to London and beyond. I never submitted to David Marcus, because I was waiting until I thought I had something worth consideration, by which time he had stopped editing the page. I was introduced to him once, at one of those events in Dublin where everyone but me seemed to belong. What I remember isn't being introduced, but seeing him across a room and realising who he was. I felt as if I was in the room with John Lennon or Bob Dylan, as if with one of the beings so remote and indispensable that you believe they can't be real.
And so many of our writers and poets lined up to pay tribute to David Marcus. Mary O'Malley read this poem dedicated to the editor.
Sheehan for David Marcus. the Irish for knife is a dive clean as an arrow, tipped with poison from the yew, is a sliver of bay cast in steel with the edge of a swallow's flight. I have no coins to give you, just this small gift, forged with precision to gut fish, calm dangerous waves, and lift the flap of our dimensions.
From Editing Ireland, David Marcus. On Sunday Just Gone, Send Him Home Sweating, it was the Mary Wallopers Showband Show.
I'm Charles Hendy and I'm sitting here with Adam Clayton from a band called U2. Don't know if you've ever heard of them. And we're here talking about show bands at the moment. This next lady that I'm going to play, I was watching recently interviews with, and she seems unbelievable. And the amount of effort that she put into her hair. There's an interview with her talking about her hair, and I saw some photos of her hair. If you get a chance, when you're listening to this, look up Eileen Reid and her hair. And this is Eileen Reid and the Cadets. Are You Teasing Me?
And from there to Making It in Ireland's comedy scene, a feature from Emer McCauley. And for stand-up Kevin Larney, well, making a living out of it, tricky. He has a side hustle as a tour guide. He also has a podcast. But the dream is to make it on stage.
Your average audience would be like, you know, four students from Germany and a couple from Japan on holidays and maybe five middle-aged Americans and a hen party from Wales. So it's always this kind of like trying to quickly shift between different groups, keep them all interested, keep them all in the room, talk about something that they'll all understand. So I think that night in particular, there's lots of different people from all over the world and they're all pretty drunk. So it's kind of like finding at least one thing that they can all relate to. And I think if you do that, they're more interested in, you'll almost see them, you kind of talk directly to them and they almost wake up and realize that they're in the room. Also, that only works in rooms of like, you know, 30 or so people. You couldn't do that in the SSE arena. But I've gotten very good at doing bad gigs. Like after COVID, whatever, spending so much time inside and I was still doing the podcast in the background and editing that. And by the time we finished, stuff started to open up again. I kind of just wanted to jump. I'd also saved all the money that I'd made during COVID because I couldn't go anywhere or spend it on anything.
When you were telling people, okay, I'm going to do comedy full time, did anyone in your life think that was a bit of a crazy choice?
I think there was a real, this was like what, November 2021? I feel like everyone was kind of coming out of COVID and going into that Christmas. There was a lot of like, I'm growing my hair and opening the pottery business I always wanted to open. I'm not going back into the bloody 9-to-5. This has changed everything. Now, that has slowly faded away in the last couple of years, but there was a real, I think at the time when I said I was going to stop working and go full into comedy, everyone was kind of saying the same thing.
And how has it been to do it? Like, you were running comedy night.
I feel like I didn't have any of that set up when I decided to do it. I've worked harder at this than I ever did in my job for much less financial stability.
Oh, living the dream, but trickier to make ends meet. That was Kevin Larney on Making It in Ireland's comedy scene. And from Ireland way back to the Caribbean, not a link you might easily assume, but on Irish Imperial Lives, Kate O'Malley and A.B. Philbin Bowman brought us this Dublin sailor. His name is James Field Stanfield, and he served aboard a ship carrying enslaved Africans. Here's Dr. Catherine Healy of the Epic Museum in Dublin.
James Field Stanfield was born in Dublin in the 1740s. He had actually trained for the priesthood, but ended up not taking orders. And instead, he became a merchant sailor. And in the 1770s, he joins a crew sailing from Liverpool to West Africa to Benin, which was a major exporter of enslaved people. You had a considerable number of European ships arriving on this particular stretch of coast every year to cram hundreds of people into their holds and transport them across the Atlantic. So Stanfield joins that ship, spends a number of months in Africa, and then joins the crew of a ship headed across the Middle Passage. They were going to Jamaica, and they had more than 200 captured Africans on board. And it was during those next few months that he really saw with clarity the brutality and inhumanity of the system, which results in the publication in 1788 of his observations on a Guinea voyage, which ended up becoming a really important account.
So important, in fact, that it was used by the abolitionist movement as a key text in highlighting the brutality of the transatlantic trade in human beings.
There's a particularly moving scene in one of those accounts where he describes two women embracing each other and jumping into the water together in a kind of a final act of tenderness before they both decide to end their lives because it's better than where they are. And I think he even describes the rest of the crew having to put all the other women below deck immediately because they were about to follow suit. How impactful is this writing, and how impactful are these accounts at the time?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, it's important in that, as Kate said, it's the first eyewitness account of transatlantic enslavement by a common sailor. And it's a very graphic account and quite unlike anything previously published. Stanfield speaks of this impenetrable veil that's been thrown over the trade. He feels that people are not aware of the extent of the brutality, and he was determined to lift that veil. So a number of years after he returns to Britain, he writes to the abolitionist Thomas Clarkson about the conditions he saw, and those letters were collated and published by the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. And you have extracts reprinted then in newspapers in Britain and America. But I suppose the terror at the very heart of this account, I think, is important. The historian Trevor Bernard has written about this. He says that accounts like Stanfield's were really important in shifting opinion among educated Britons on enslavement, and the horror and terror they conveyed were really pivotal to eradicating that idea of enslavement as a necessary evil.
From Irish Imperial Lives. And on In the Smoke, Dearnay Glacken brought us stories of Irish immigrants, and in South Boston, Southie's Pat Nee, a one-time major crime figure in the area and a former member of the Mullen and Winter Hill gangs. He was also a well-known IRA sympathiser. He'd come to America at the age of 8.
And I landed, my father found the only Sicilian section of Southie and plopped us right down in the middle.
Wow.
Yo. It was different. My mother learned to cook Italian before anything else because all the neighbors were Italian and they would teach her different things. Nice people.
Wow.
I didn't know anything about gangs at that age, just that these guys always had the nice cars, the nice women, and they were always well-dressed. And some of them would just get a check every week. They didn't have to work, you know. So I said, I want to be one of them guys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's what started me in crime, watching them, the older guys, how they lived. I used to sneak into the bar room, it was called the Lighthouse, with my shoe shine box and shine shoes just to watch them. By age 17, joined the Marines all over the world. And then I came back. I wanted to be a criminal. I didn't want to work. I wanted to do what the older guys were still doing. Come back 4 years later, and I used to hound them to bring me on scores. Then they started bringing me, robbing trucks, stealing trailers full of tuna fish, whatever was on there, we would steal it.
And he also encountered the notorious Whitey Bulger.
I fought Whitey Bulger for 2.5 years. We shot at each other and missed.
The Western.
And he was with the Cleans. Okay. They were the organized crime group, Irish group at the time. They were very... Everything was structured, and we were the wild group. You know, no one wanted anything to do with us because we were kind of uncontrollable. We really didn't care about them and their reputation, you know. And then the shooting started, and the Cleans lost. Whitey lost. We beat them.
Okay.
Two of them got killed. It was a wild time.
Wow.
It was a crazy time, but it ended. The Italians wanted it to end, and how we wanted it to end, because there was too much heat. That type of violence brings a lot of scrutiny from police. We ended everything and made kind of a weird peace. I mean, we really didn't trust each other. Yeah. I was already part of the Winter Hill crew at that time, and Whitey worked his way in. Unbeknownst to us, he was an FBI informant. Yeah. Three of them ambushed me once up the street here. I pulled in and they pulled right up. And there was three of them shooting. And they killed my car, but the windows got blown out, the engine was hit and everything. All I got was glass cuts. Wow. I crawled out of the car, got into an alleyway real quick and got away. Whitey had to have people captured tied to a chair. He was not a hunter. He was not a good shooter. He was not a good person.
No.
A very sick man, as we found out. By degrees.
And if you thought the Boston Irish community might be appalled by all of this criminality and violence, not quite.
When all this was going on, and obviously an awful lot of violence, like in the general community, were you kind of ostracised a bit? Or
no, back then it was a criminal type community. Yeah. People were either involved in the waterfront, longshoring. There was bookies all over the place. There was housewives and grandmothers that would sit in the window, and you could go bet. It was illegal bet back then. And they were the best ones because no one suspected them. They'd be sitting in the window, you walk by, give them your numbers. They'd say, okay. You know, the dog racing was at night in the summer. And these are the old phones. You have to dial. And we had Aggie Manville. She's in a wheelchair. We had her house set up with 10 phones to reach out to our agents. She made us a fortune because she was quick. She knew everything. She was just she was a criminal.
Talking to Dearney Glacken from In the Smoke. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Much of the news this week was dominated by an attack in New Orleans by a man who drove a truck into New Year's Eve revelers, killing at least 14 people. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, journalist Steve Futterman spoke to Gavin.
This 42-year-old man, Shamsuddin Jabbar, drove this vehicle at high speed through the streets where it was 3 a.m. But in New Orleans, you know, the morning after the New Year's arrives, there are still plenty of people partying. It was almost an all-night party. And we've heard from eyewitnesses describing, just one person said it was like a horror movie watching this vehicle hit something, either a person or some type of object. It would fly up in the air. It just kept flying through and flying through. And then the man got out of the vehicle, started firing his weapon, and eventually he was gunned down.
And while initially there were fears that this might be linked to a wider terrorist threat, as the week ended, the FBI said that Shamsuddin Jabbar appears to have acted alone, albeit inspired by ISIS. On Thursday's Drive Time, Sarah spoke to former CIA director John Brennan.
It's interesting that you're saying they're inspired by ISIS, because I know there's been no claim of responsibility by ISIS yet for the attack. Do you think that makes it more likely that he was inspired by ISIS as opposed to directed by ISIS?
Well, ISIS has inspired people over the years around the globe. They are very adept users of social media and the digital environment. And it appears as though Jabbar had released a video on a social media platform, basically saying he was doing this on behalf of ISIS. There was the ISIS Islamic State flag that was on his vehicle. And again, according to the latest FBI information, it appears as though he had become radicalized this over the summer, and then because of a variety of personal problems, he was in financial difficulty, he had some mental health issues, he had been divorced several times and was behind on child support payments. He might have then decided to carry out this attack and using the ISIS ideology as part of his motivation.
Shamsuddin Jabbar was born in Texas and was an army veteran who'd served in Afghanistan, prompting Sarah to ask this.
How big a blow is it, John, generally to the American psyche that this is a US veteran who would carry out an attack like this?
Well, unfortunately, we've had a number of incidents over the past years that have been carried out, these terrorist attacks by U.S. military personnel. And there are some very lethal attacks that were carried out previously. You know, the U.S. military is a very large force. It's, you know, over a million active duty members and many millions of veterans. And so it's a part of the American society that, you know, the veteran community. So it's unsurprising that a lot of veterans are maybe facing the same challenges as other American citizens. And unfortunately, I think some of them fall prey to either the inspiration of ISIS, as well as just desperation in terms of maybe some acts that they take in order to escape from some of their personal troubles.
From Thursday's Drive Time. And FBI officials also said they found no definitive link between the deadly attack and the explosion of a Tesla Cybertruck outside of the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas. However, on Morning Ireland yesterday, Áine put this to David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief with The Guardian.
It's still a worrying backdrop, isn't it, though, for authorities trying to ensure that Jimmy Carter's funeral events, they begin on the 4th, don't they, that they go off without any more incidents like this?
Yes. It's very worrying timing in many ways. And I think, you know, for many Americans, tensions are running high, you know, going into a new year with a series of set piece events. I mean, New Orleans itself has the Mardi Gras festival and next month the Super Bowl, the biggest sporting event in America. More widely, as you say, Jimmy Carter's state funeral begins on Saturday in Georgia, where he was from originally. Then it will come to Washington. There'll be a big state funeral event at the Washington National Cathedral with every living president expected to attend. And then, of course, we're building up towards the inauguration of Donald Trump as president on January the 20th. These are all massive security operations at a moment when tensions are high. So I think efforts will be stepped up even more in an attempt to keep people safe.
From Morning Ireland yesterday. And also making the news, although probably not a huge surprise to any would-be house hunters out there, house prices went up by 9% last year, the biggest annual jump since 2017. The national average house price is just over €332,000, more than seven times the average salary. Ronan Lyons, economist at Trinity College and author of the Daft Report, spoke to Gavin.
The biggest annual increase in asking prices in 7 years. Why?
Ultimately, this is about the second-hand market, which is dominant in the market for owner-occupiers. There are far more transactions involving second-hand homes than new builds. And the flow of properties onto the second-hand market has slowed down considerably over the last 18 months or so. It's still falling a little bit more slowly now, but it has come down quite a bit. Over the course of the year 2024, about 51,000 properties were listed. That's down from about 62,000 in 2022.
And why the fall in the availability of second-hand houses?
Yeah, it's down to the increase in the well-flagged increase in interest rates. So with people having noticed that interest rates were going up, those who have mortgages fixed those mortgages. And that means when you think about it, if you fix your mortgage rate and rates have gone up, there's really very little incentive to go into the open market to sell your property and trade up or trade down. And that's weighing down on the volume of properties coming onto the market. And it's also only going to resolve itself slowly. People fixed for 3, 5 or 7 years. In most cases in 2021 or 2022. And if you do the maths, that means between last year and 2029, those properties will come off their fixed rates. And that's really the length of time it'll take for the secondhand market to get back to normal as things stand.
So if you are trying to save a bit of money for the house or indeed for anything, you might be in the market for this. Simply Don't Spend. Anna Geary in Foray spoke to Kaz Mooney from Irish Budgeting.
So no spent days is a day where you spend absolutely no money except for any bills and direct debits that come out of your account. So I like to track them and see how many I can get in a month.
Okay, so like, but even for people starting out, I would imagine even if they just tried the one or maybe then built it up maybe to one a week because...
Yeah, so even having, saying you're going to have two or three or even one no spend day a week can be so helpful because often you will realise in that day the times you would have spent money kind of unintentionally.
Yeah, it probably gives you an opportunity as well to maybe to assess where the temptations lie. Because what are the things that you were most likely to try and spend the money on those days?
Yeah, like it could be, it's often those habits. So you're often like looking at somebody in the office with a coffee and they're going, look, I'm going down to the cafe. Do you want one? And before you know it, you've spent, you know, a couple of euro here, a couple of euro there. Whereas if you're intentionally going, I'm not spending any money today, you're going to bring in that flask into work or you're going to make sure that you have all the food you need in the house. You're not going to be tempted to go get that last minute takeaway. It's all these little things that add up
and even mark them in the calendar so that everybody knows that's the no spend day. And you know, I suppose
oh, great crack for the year ahead. But what if you are a thrifty saver but the person you live with, well, flinging it around?
How should you approach them and include them in the bigger picture for family finances?
So I would recommend definitely chatting to them and saying to them that you're going to start looking at your finances and talking to them about what goals you have and seeing if they have similar goals. With partners, I think it's really important to not necessarily pressure them into going the same way you are right now. I know with my own partner, it took him a little while to get used to the idea. Mm-hmm. So what we did instead is I budgeted and he didn't. And then eventually he realised he needed to budget too because I had the money to fix the car and he didn't.
Okay, so he started to think about maybe your way of doing things was slightly better.
Yeah.
Ooh, both rich and righteous. What's not to like? And you could also make a bit of a killing or at least a good swap by asking for the gift receipt for those presents sitting on the shelf. If indeed you're that kind of person.
I am not joking when I tell you that I have never once in my life returned a present. Even presents that I've got that were clearly and absolutely useless. I've never once brought them back.
Consumer journalist and walking saint Connor Pope. He was in with Anya Kerr. Now, to be clear, he's not against returns per se. He's not into the waste. But asking for the gift receipt, if you are that kind of person, a minefield.
What's the etiquette for asking somebody for the gift receipt?
Well, that's tricky. Because basically, you're not just asking someone for a gift receipt. Yeah. You're putting a value judgment on the present they bought you. So you said, you're basically saying, you know that present you bought me, it's terrible, I hate it, and I want to bring it back. So maybe if in terms of the etiquette, I think a little white lie mightn't be too far away from where you need to be. So it doesn't really fit. Or I actually have that shade already, or whatever it might be. But don't say to someone, listen, your present, your choice, your taste is terrible. I want the gift receipt.
Make the right thing.
Bit late for diplomacy now. Oh, well. On New Year's Day, Louise Duffy had the mighty Damien Dempsey in for a studio session. He spoke some wise words.
Damien, what is busting out of here about? Where did that come from?
Busting out of here, Louise, it's sort of it's about breaking out of a headspace where you're beating yourself up. And this is a good message for your listeners to go into 2025 with. Don't be beating yourself up because plenty of lachicos will do that for you.
Yes, they're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Ready to go, yeah?
And that might well be the best advice on radio all week. That is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Your walls seem so high. They never fail to terrify. Build that fear and shame.